You're watching Channel 37. WHXN. New Salem.
Interactivity. That's what Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show is all about. We hearken back to the glory days when you would go to a movie and the theater would throw paper mache ghosts at you. We open with the Tingler. You will believe a man can have a giant earwig inside him eating his spine? After that, John Goodman will make you forget there are any other actors in Matinee.
Hello and welcome to John Grayson's Midnight Movie Show. I'm Dan, and with me are Dave.
Hello.
Wendy.
Hi there.
And Will.
The result would be Bant.
Indeed. Result!
So, Dave, you chose the movie this week, and what did you bring to us?
I have brought unto you The Tingler.
Indeed you have, sir.
I'm William Castle, and I feel obligated to warn you about the next attraction you will see at this theater. The picture is The Tingler, which I directed. And for the first time in motion picture history, members of the audience, including you, will actually play a part in the picture. You will feel some of the physical reactions, the shocking sensations experienced by the actors on the screen. I guarantee that The Tingler has more shocks per minute than my last film, The House on Haunted Hill. But don't be alarmed. You can protect yourself. When you see the picture, you will be told and remember the instruction how you can guard yourself from attack by The Tingler. And now may I show you a few scenes from The Tingler?
And pray tell, what is The Tingler?
So The Tingler is the story of Dr. Warren Chapin, who is like a pathologist and doctor, who has become obsessed with, after doing autopsies on people who've got the electric chair, that there is some sort of moment of pure fear that can crush a human being's spine. We meet him as he's meets another guy called what's his name? Ollie.
Mm-hmm. Ollie.
Yeah, who's like the brother-in-law of the person he's doing the autopsy on, and he tells him about this, and Ollie christens it The Tingler. And so he has become obsessed with this. Randomly, he decides to go home with Ollie to meet his wife, who just happens to be a deaf mute, which obviously that will pay off later. And it turns out that Warren doesn't have the greatest relationship with his wife, who is Isabel. And she's seeing other men and she's tired of his work, sort of like drawing attention away from him. It looks like he's going to murder her, but then it turns out that he was just doing that to see if he can encourage The Tingler out as a moment of pure fear. So when she kind of faints, he takes a couple of x-rays of her spine and then shows his assistant, David, that something was kind of leaping up her spine at the moment of fear. And it seems that screaming can release that. So there is a period of further experimentation. Dr. Chapin takes a voyage to Tripout City in order to try and encourage fear in himself to try and kind of like capture The Tingler. But eventually his resolve breaks and he screams, which neutralizes it. And then it occurs to him, well, as an idle thought, that somebody who couldn't scream wouldn't be able to get that release, and therefore he'd be able to get a live Tingler. The word Tingler will be said so often in this, it will lose all meaning. So it turns out that Ollie's wife has a pathological fear of blood. She faints earlier in the film because Warren gets a slight cut on his hand. She's still feeling off, so Warren goes to give her an injection and some sleeping tablets. Ollie's wife is then treated to all sorts of scary imagery, and the shock is so much that she dies. Ollie takes the body around to Warren to examine. He finds the Tingler intact and removes it from her body. And it turns out the Tingler is sort of like a big, a gigantic earwig that's been attached to her spine, which has a very strong grip. So strong enough to crack a human spine. So after a bit of wrangling, they manage to get it in a box. Isabel proceeds to then try to use the Tingler to murder Warren. But he's saved by Isabel's sister and David's fiance, who are one and the same person. That's not two people. she comes in, screams, and disables the Tingler. He gets it back in the box again, and it turns out, in a big twist, that it was actually Ollie who had scared his wife to death, thanks to a bunch of props that he had. So he goes rattling around, Warren works this out, goes round. The Tingler escapes its box and gets into the movie theatre downstairs that Ollie runs. It then gets a bit meta with the Tingler running around and Vincent Price appearing and directly to the audience and telling them to scream. The Tingler is eventually disabled again and placed in a... old film can. Warren wants to put it back into Ollie's wife because it's unkillable in all other ways. They've tried, freezing it, putting a blowtorch to it, all sorts. So he replaces the Tingler back in the now deceased wife. Warren leaves, but the Tingler hijacks the body of Ollie's wife and is about, and the film ends with it about to wreak revenge upon Ollie for what he's done, and a cautionary warning to the audience that the next time you feel a tingle in your spine, don't forget to scream.
Was this anybody's first time seeing this?
It was mine.
Me, actually, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I sort of suggested this because I thought it was a fun idea to cover a film which had a gimmick. Mm-hmm. So, as for anybody listening who may not be aware, this is a film produced and directed by William Castle. And as part of the gimmick when watching it, there were kind of small electrical charges in some of the seats that provided a literal tingle up the spine while watching it. And William Castle does appear at the start of the film, warning people that they might experience a tingling sensation. So that's kind of why I thought it would be a fun movie to bring to the table.
Okay, cool. Because I was going to say, other than because it's kind of awesome, why did you make this movie? okay, well then you got to see it for yourself. What did you think of it?
I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, it was everything I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. In some senses, the science is magnificent, Hogan. Complete nonsense. But fortunately, they've got Vincent Price, so you could give it some gravitas. Mm-hmm. But there were some twists in this I was not expecting. Mm-hmm. I wasn't expecting Ollie to turn out to be the killer. That caught me off guard. And the whole sequence where Ollie's wife is experiencing terror, there's a couple of really unexpected moments where they've inserted colour into a black and white film. As part of her fear response, you see the taps running blood, and then you see a bath that's full of blood and a hand comes through it, and that's all bright red against the black and white background, which I kind of saw how they'd done it, but it was still kind of cool and unexpected. I hadn't expected them to pull that stroke during the film, so I had a couple of moments in this where I was kind of like, oh wow, like this, I didn't see that coming. And overall, I mean, it's your standard button down scientist encounters the supernatural and puffs his pipe at it. But, you know, that's what I was expecting it to be. And as an example of the brand, I thought it was really good.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Will, how about yourself? You said this was also your first time?
It was. I was vaguely familiar with the film because I can't remember. When I was a lot younger, I remember reading an article or something on films with gimmicks. And I was always like, that sounds interesting. I would like to experience that film someday, how he intended, but I probably never will because that sounds like a lot of extra work. Mm-hmm. But anyway around, this was my first time seeing the film. I was relatively, surprised that honestly, if I'd seen the film with the gimmick, I probably wouldn't have cared, but I mean, seeing it without it, and if I never knew about the gimmick of it, I probably would have just, you know, liked it all the same. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, it's just kind of, it's a really interesting, like, slow burn to the entire film. And it helps that, you know, you have Vincent Price there just like hamming it up the entire time. And like all the actors are kind of hamming it up, but they're all like just having the time of their lives with it. Like literally, I'm this close to thinking that Vincent Price's wife in the film was, if she had had a mustache, she would have been twirling it constantly. But yeah, no, I mean, it's a fun time. It had like there's a sequence in the film where it's a black and white film, and then just out of nowhere there's like this splash of red blood in it, and I'm like, it's really effective how they pulled it off and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Wendy, I know that you have seen this before multiple times.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on it?
I mean, it's delightful nonsense, right? Like, it's the film itself is a little thin on story. It's really all about the Tingler effect, right? And so we actually had an opportunity to go see that in a rigged theater not that long ago, and we missed out. They did a whole William Castle series where they did one film a week with the original stunts. I know, right? I'm always talking about how I love that old art house theater, and they rigged some of the seats. But you know, it's a lot of fun. You know, the actors are definitely, I mean, they're hamming it up, but they seem like they're having a good time. Right. The Tingler itself is so creepy, goofy. Like, it really is like a giant earwig. It's not even really a puppet. It's just kind of rubbery, and they flail it around to make it look alive. I do love the absolute villain that his wife Isabel is. And that was spot on, Will. Like, she would be twirling a mustache. In fact, I wish they'd given her one, because that would have been really interesting. And she has such a weird relationship with her sister, who seems like a grown-ass adult, but she's still her ward and so can't access her money. Like, there's this whole subplot about, like, what a rich bitch Isabel is. I don't know. Like, it's a fun movie. Vincent Price is great in it. I love the scene where... what's his name? Ollie decides to scare his wife to death because the pranks he pulls are so goofy. He's clearly got like chairs on wires to like make them move around. At one point, he's got like the Grinch hand coming through the door with like these weird long furry fingers. But
it's like Scooby-Doo.
It's very Scooby-Doo. But yeah, there's just not a lot of movie here. It's enjoyable. But it's not great cinema, right?
I mean, I must admit, I was sort of taken in by the scary stuff because, like, it's strongly implied that the shot he's given, that Warren's given the wife, is the same stuff that he took. So, you know, he's kind of lulling you into think that everything she's seeing is her hallucinating. Mm-hmm. So, but then, sort of, as you say, Wendy, sort of once it's revealed that Ollie's been doing it, it's like, what, really? You planned all of this out? So went to the costume store. I'll take your creepiest furry hands, my good sir.
Really, where does he get these things? Where does he have the time? Like, it's, yeah.
Like, did he get the bathtub from Pleasantville? I mean, is that how?
Kind
of. Oh yeah. I mean, again, this movie was just the goofiest fucking thing, but it was a lot of fun. And it 100% would not have worked without Vincent Price. Like, if you've got to have the dignified scientist kind of wrestling with a rubber earwig, you kind of got to have Vincent Price be the guy doing it. And he's obvious. I mean, he knows what he's there to do. That's the job that they hired him to do. And he just, yeah, he's having a great time. Like, I love, again, when the Tingler is in the movie theater and, like, you see the shadow of it crawling across the screen and you can almost hear it go, grr, arg.
Yeah.
I mean, the bit where I actually laughed out loud was when it was coming into the projection booth and it was just waggling up and down as it was coming towards the projectionist. But that was the moment I cracked and actually just laughed out loud. It was hilarious.
It was so funny. And again, the movie knows how goofy it is. It's not trying to be high art. It's just trying to be entertaining to kids, right? I mean, that's essentially what it's there to do. And it does that extremely well.
I was half expecting it to pull a Blazing Saddles and that the film that everyone's watching is The Tingler when it escapes into the movie theater.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, like everybody said, the wife is just delightfully evil. This, you know, like you think that he's taken this heel turn when he's ready to murder her, and it turns out that nope, he's just an asshole who made her faint so that he could, you know, try to pull a giant earwig out of her back. The character of the sister, whose name I'm not remembering off the top of my head.
Lucy,
thank you. She doesn't have a lot to do, but, you know, she adores Vincent Price's character, which is really kind of funny considering how much her sister can't stand her. And I guess the actor that played her boyfriend / Price's assistant was actually not an actor. He was her boyfriend in real life.
Oh,
they
right.
decided to bring in, but he did a great job.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a role that doesn't demand much other than wearing a jacket and saying terms, isn't it, really?
Yeah, just can you sit there and call something the Tingler with a straight face?
Yeah.
You're hired. You know?
I mean, honestly, could probably have deleted the character completely and you lose nothing from the film.
Yeah, he just needed somebody to explain things to occasionally. Half the time it was Ollie anyway.
I mean, in a way, I mean, I know you guys have been saying that Price hams it up, and he does a bit, but, like, this isn't Theater of Blood, Vincent Price. You know, I mean, there is a scale to the Vincent Price hamming it up.
Mm-hmm. We haven't quite hit the Monster Club yet.
Yeah. we're not quite sort of the last 5 minutes of Dead Heat here. He is heightened, but, like, at the same time, I think he's doing his best to sell this. Like, because he knows he's the focal point upon which this hangs.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, Dan, like the first sort of, I don't know, about 10, 20 minutes are quite slow burn. It's just lots of conversations in rooms. And and both Ollie and Warren just come across as kind of nice, chatty people who just happen to have bumped into each other and, you know, started talking about work. And then, like you say, it appears to take a turn south when Warren pretends to shoot his wife. You think, oh no, he's actually a dick. and then he's thinking, yeah, you know, you think he's going to be drugging Ollie's wife. Oh god, no, he is actually a dick. And then Ollie turns out to him and go, oh no, he's the dick.
Yeah, but I mean, like you say, Dave, I mean, Vincent Price is, yeah, he's aware of what kind of movie he's in, and he pitches his performance accordingly. He's not making fun of it, but he is having fun with it.
Yeah.
So.
And also, this film is very much a victory for high-waisted trousers everywhere.
Of course.
Lots of very high-waisted trousers and long-cut jackets. I was kind of noting the fashion.
And apparently, this was the first movie to portray an LSD trip.
Oh, okay. Is that what that stuff was supposed to be? Right, okay.
Yes, they straight up said that it was lysergic acid.
Yeah. Well, I represent it was a kind of acid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, if at any point he was super hamming it up, it was during that scene. But that's kind of what that sort of scene is for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming that the tingle gimmick was kicking in whenever there was that. Because whenever you see the tingler, there's that kind of heartbeat sound. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming there'd be, like, you know, in time with the throb, you'd get that in the scene. I mean, I'm just speculating because I...
Yeah, I know that they did it during the scene at the end, like when the screen goes black and he's saying, scream, scream for your lives.
Right.
And then you'd kind of get the little, little jolt. And then, in theory, the audience would start screaming, which would make other people start screaming.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. Yeah. Wendy, what happened? Like, did they, like, I know we didn't actually get to go to that screening, but as I recall, didn't they say like that particular one, like the, it didn't work or something?
One, I don't remember. Yeah, like, one, for one of the films, the thing didn't work and they ended up like showing a different film. I don't remember which one it was. I know they got the House on Haunted Hill effect to work. Cause some friends went to that, but I don't remember.
I feel like it was the Tingler that the Percepto just wasn't working or something, which is a shame.
That's too bad. But,
yeah. Because I mean, 13 Ghosts, isn't that just like, don't you just need glasses for that one?
Yes. It's like it's like 3D glasses, but like the red's on top of the blue or something.
Well, and the Coolidge has a real silver screen, so they can still do like the red blue glasses.
Yeah.
I was sitting there thinking, how would I pull it off now? Because like wiring a movie theater up for electricity feels like something a lot of places probably wouldn't let you do. But I was thinking, like, you know those things they give you in some restaurants that vibrate when your order's ready?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a bunch of those in the seats.
I think that's what it was. I think that, again, they weren't like giving the audience electric shocks. I think it was like basically like a big joy buzzer.
Yeah, I think that's really what it was.
Yeah. And to some extent, that stuff is back around. I mean, there's the entire 4D movie thing that where the seats actually shake. And I know at least I had a couple friends who saw like twisters in it, and they ended up getting whiplash out of it.
Oh wow! Yeah, if you got to go to the furniture store to the Motion Odyssey movie ride,
mom.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like William Castle was possibly a little ahead of his time in terms of sort of a lot of this kind of gimmicky stuff.
I think that's true.
And also just the fact that he kind of appears at the start of it, sort of like Alfred Hitchcock from Wish.
Well, it's like at the beginning of Frankenstein, where Carl Laemmle comes out and just says, this is going to scare the shit out of you. You probably going to want to leave right now before you have a heart attack and die at how scary this movie is.
But yeah, it's like somebody who is so synonymous with the product that he could be on screen, you know, addressing the audience about and sort of feeding into the gimmick as well. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're hard pressed to think of anybody who's like the equivalent of that these days. I mean, like, you know, I mean, maybe someone like Kevin Feige, but like, yeah, he's not coming out at the start of Black Panther going like,
yeah.
I wonder. Is the modern day equivalent like films that build like an elaborate web thing, like a presence? I mean, it's been a while, but the thing that jumps to mind is all of the hype that like the Blair Witch Project folks did before they released the film.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Kind of like creating that experience outside of the film.
Yeah, that's probably a really good example, actually. Yeah, yeah. That kind of just building the legend around the film of, you know, this thing is so terrifying, it's going to, you know, like, it's so harrowing.
And of course, it's kind of like, it's fine.
Yeah. And they did a similar thing back with, whatchamacallit, Cloverfield.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because I remember seeing that trailer for Cloverfield where you have absolutely no clue what the fuck the film is about, and then going out of their way to keep you from figuring out, oh, it's a giant monster movie. And it's also a found footage film.
Yeah. And also TJ Miller's in it.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, no, I think there was a lot of little surprises in this. Really enjoyed it. Absolutely, yeah, a fun time. And yeah, it gets a little bit confused towards the end. Like, maybe it doesn't quite stick the landing, but I think at that point they're just kind of say, look, you had your fun, go home.
It doesn't end so much as it just kind of stops.
Yeah.
Well, they should have lit something on fire then.
Yeah. Absolutely. We all know, but when in doubt, burn something.
But the Tingler's immune to fire.
Like, I shouldn't be dwelling on this because it's not that kind of movie, but the entire time watching it was like, you're telling me that at no point in human history has anybody ever seen this gigantic rubber earwig that's in the back of this person's spine? Ever. No one's ever died with this gigantic thing stuck to the back of their spine.
But the science, Dan! Yeah, everybody screamed! There was science!
It's true. It's true. Oh, just follow the science. Yeah, I know. I feel better than this.
Yeah, it was a great thing about it. It was explained so earnestly and so deadpan that, like, if you knew absolutely nothing about science, I can see you being duped into thinking this might be a thing that's real.
And it looked like the thing that Khan used to, you know, pull the little boar worms to stick into Chekhov's ear.
They gave Chekhov the tingler.
Chekhov's tingler. If it tingles in the first act, it has to tingle by the end.
Nice.
I mean, like, the unintentional hilarity, or possibly intentional hilarity, of hearing Vincent Price shout at someone, "Quick, grab the tingler," is just like...
Oh. It was the 1950s, Dave. Think clean, think clean thoughts.
The Joker's got a boner.
And I know that Spengoolie shows this at least once a year, which is always fun. Oh, the first time I saw it, like the very first time I saw it, was actually in a theater, because Trace Beaulieu and Frank Conniff were touring with it, doing their The Mads tour. Mm-hmm. They were riffing on it. We saw it, Wendy. We saw it, I think, at the Regent in Arlington. Okay. That's the very first time I ever saw it, and that was a lot of fun.
Excellent. I mean, if I ever get a chance to see this in a cinema, I'm absolutely going.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, that's sort of like buzzing seats or no buzzing seats. I'll be showing up for that.
Well, I think this is like the only monster movie he did, at least at for a long time, because mostly he did like thrillers and like ghost stories and stuff. But they're all just... Oh, what was on a couple weeks? It was on TV a couple weeks ago. Straight Jacket was on a couple weeks ago.
I fucking love Straight Jacket.
Straight Jacket with Joan Crawford in full on Mommy Dearest mode.
Oh,
so good.
Just like right off the set of Baby Jane. Oh, and I don't remember what that might not have even had a gimmick. That might have just been, you know what, Joan's fine all by herself.
The wig was the gimmick. But
he handed out paper axes.
Oh, okay, yes.
I just thought Shyamalan. That's the modern William Castle, Shyamalan.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, the guy's known for the twist and the
yeah. What a twist? Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, I can see that. But yeah, basically, if you have the opportunity to see pretty much any William Castle movie in a theater with a crowd, you should do it.
For sure.
Because you're going to get entertained somehow. you know, papier-mâché ghosts flying through the audience or no papier-mâché ghosts flying through the audience, you're going to have a good time.
Yeah, anyone listening to this hasn't seen it, go find it. Like, it's on YouTube on public domain movies, so like, it's pretty easy to find.
Yeah.
The one person I really need to single out really quick, though, Judith Evelyn, who plays Martha, the mute wife.
Oh, yes.
Like, just does a freaking terrific job without even saying another word. And just knowing that her other biggest role is also she never speaks in, which is Miss Lonely Hearts in Rear Window.
Oh, yes. Right, okay.
I was reading, apparently... Price insisted that she be cast because he had just done something on Broadway with her.
Right.
And like, she was like, "Oh, she's terrific. She's exactly who you're looking for this." So,
Although, yeah. The sign language he was doing was clearly bollocks.
Oh, yeah.
It was nothing. Like, she's miming things at one point. It's like she's doing shadow puppets. It's a body rabbit. Like.
Yeah, they did not have an ASL interpreter on set.
Is that, yes, we've included somebody with a disability because it's necessary to the plot, but we're not going to do any research to actually portray it accurately.
No.
But it was still just kind of like, see, oh right, okay, she's deaf, but oh, what's she doing with her hands? Because that doesn't look right. Like, I'm no expert, but I'm pretty sure that's not sign language.
One thing that I thought was kind of cool was. It had this kind of little bit where they talk about, in the 50s, obviously, the movies are starting to compete with TV, and so the big movie theaters are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. But you still had these little second-run theaters or boutique houses that were kind of labors of love, but it was, like, incredibly hard work that made no money.
Yeah.
You could almost feel Castle kind of lamenting the state of these little theaters
that yeah.
were just kind of getting fallen by the wayside.
Yeah, just playing kind of silent films.
Well, little theaters yeah. like yeah. that would have been his bread and butter, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Oh, yeah, like the big Lowe's multiplex of its day would not have been interested in the Tingler. Wait, you want to put what in our seats?
Well, it's gotten to the point where even like the little dollar theaters where, oh, you can see a movie that was in the theater like 4 months ago for a dollar. Those don't even exist as much anymore because, oh, for the same amount of money, you can just stream it on Netflix.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, again, Wendy and I, we're in Boston. We're like spoiled for choice. There are tons of second run movie houses here, but it's easy to forget that like it's super rare most places.
Yeah, it really is. Anymore.
The whole concept of second run just doesn't exist. It just goes to streaming or video.
Yeah, it's the point where, like, you're waiting on Fathom to, decide, hey, we're going to, guess what? We're going to, as a treat, you can see Sunset Boulevard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Side note, as a treat, next later this year, I can see Sunset Boulevard.
There you go. we're very, very fortunate that we have those opportunities a lot more often than most people. But it's a shame. Like, you could almost smell that theater.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was starting to get quite into the film they were showing. They showed enough of it, I was getting kind of hooked on the plot.
Tolerable Dave?
Is it David? It's supposed to be, like, based on the David? Myth of, like, the David and Goliath story.
Yeah. But like, that was a real movie that was apparently a huge hit in like 1924 or something, but
they'd use something that existed because it was cheap.
Because it was cheap, or possibly even public domain at that point, because again, these movies don't get to 90 minutes by themselves, do they?
Yeah, that's very true.
They were not shy about showing footage from that movie.
No.
How could such a thing happen, Dr. Grabow?
The ant's saliva must have gotten into Bill's bloodstream and gone straight to his brain, just as the radiation, which is measured in units called Rentgens, was released.
And that's how he became a...
mant.
Gotcha! For the kids of Key West, Florida, there was nothing scarier than a monster matinee.
Lawrence Woolsey, the master of movie horror, exterminates you with... mant!
The story of Matt is based on scientific fact, on theories that have appeared in national magazines.
But in the fall of 1962...
A series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on the island of Cuba.
They got the biggest scare of all.
They're gonna bomb us?
The country is on red alert.
And what a perfect time to open a new horror movie.
That'd be the best show to take a girl to.
The whole world's gonna blow up anyway, so we should just do whatever we want.
You know, last guy she went out with in reform school?
He did teach me a lot.
What about?
About my body.
Think of the bomb we're about to fall, she'd do it with me.
Wait till you see the feelers on this thing.
Uno, dos, one, two, tres, cuatro.
Some of it's stage lighting,
Some of it's magic show stuff, but the big studios, none of them have anything like it.
Look out! Behind you!
You never, ever turn one above six.
This is it!
From Joe Dante, director of Gremlins.
You see what he's putting back? The showmanship.
The bombs are falling!
You think this is some kind of picnic for me?
Well, I'm still concerned about that bomb thing.
A little question of taste?
No, but your younger patrons, you could have some seat wetness.
John Goodman.
I love this business.
Matinee.
Man, I'm seeing this twice.
Next up, we watched Matinee, which is a Joe Dante directed love letter to both the William Castle experience, as well as just the kind of mid-century movie going culture, which was really nice.
Okay, so Matinee revolves around a film producer. Why am I? Lawrence Woolsey, who, down on his luck, basically this is his last chance, and he has this his big new movie, Mant, which the plot of Mant is its own special thing of radioactive ant bit a person and they're turning into a mant. Anyway, back to the point, he is premiering it in Key West, where it just so happens as well, Cuba and the U.S. are having a standoff with nuclear missiles, you know. the family there, the Loomises, with son Gene and his little brother, they're really excited to see this movie. They meet a bunch of friends and who also are like excited about seeing the movie. One of which, Sherry, played by a young Kelly Martin, who has a boyfriend who is definitely not a young anyone ever. he's back in town and he is basically looking to get her back, but also he was in juvie and is a criminal and very much based off an actual serial killer. So yeah, mm-hmm. There's a thing. Anyway, the movie's premiere happens. During it, like, a bunch of shit really starts going bad. Namely, the film's earthquake effects start almost destroy the balcony. People get locked in a nuclear fallout shelter. The juvenile delinquent ex-boyfriend kidnaps his girlfriend. Everything happens, and all while people are trying to watch Mant, and then they see a nuclear explosion go off. But it's just the movie. And in the end, though, the movie's a success. The producer, the first producer from Hollywood, really wants to, you know, distribute it. And turns out, okay, cool, the world didn't end.
Okay. All right. Was this anybody's first time seeing this?
Mine.
Okay. Yeah, I had seen it a long, 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 long time ago, but I did not really remember very much about it. Okay. So, Will, thank you for doing that. What did you think of it?
So, this is a film I have seen it before. I saw it back in 1994 when it was on video. Mm-hmm. Because we rented it and watched it as a family.
Okay.
And honestly, like, I remembered the broad strokes of the film that took mm-hmm. place during the Cuba Gooding Missile Crisis.
That's fantastic.
I remember that like, took place during the Cuba Missile Crisis.
We all remember where we were when Cuba Gooding went nuts. Turned into a Bond villain.
I mean, it's the only place his career really has to go. Anyway, I remember that it took place during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was why I even knew what that thing was when we got to American history in high school. Mm-hmm. I remember that it had to do with a William Castle-esque producer. Not that I would have known who William Castle was, because I was like nine or 10 when I saw this film. Mm-hmm. And Yeah, I've remembered a lot of the broad strokes, but I didn't know, you know, I didn't remember the little things like the psychotic ex-boyfriend. I did not remember how good John Goodman is in this film. Like, for whatever reason, my brain fooled me into thinking that he had a side, that he was just like a side character, not basically like the only thing keeping the plot going half the time, mm-hmm. which, you know, good for him because it's John Goodman and John Goodman is fucking awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and it's honestly like it's a fun film. Like, it's one of those films that, you know, was made kind of as part of the cycle of nostalgia in this case for the 60s. But you know, it is actually good independent of being, you know, boomer nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Wendy, what did you think? What was your thoughts on this one?
So I also saw this one back in the 90s, and also did not remember it very well. This time around, I thought it was just a lot of fun. I feel like it really captures the nostalgia, you know, for this time period. And then I picked up, like, the cast is incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, this movie has a much better cast than you think it does. And a lot of them are just babies and maybe not recognizable yet. You know, Jonathan Goodman is fantastic. I love Kathy Moriarty. And she plays, you know, his long-suffering girlfriend, who's also like a lead in most of his films, who suits up as the nurse to have people sign off on waivers to come in and see Mant.
I love that bit so much.
That's a real thing. That's a real thing.
I'm sure it is, but it's just when people keep trying to bring in genuine medical emergencies, but she keeps brushing off.
Like, nurse, he fainted. Yeah, he did.
She's just brilliant. I love that so much.
She's like,
cut yourself. Yeah, you have.
Some of the kids are great. Like, I hope I'm saying this right. Omri Katz plays Stan, like the best friend of the lead. He is Max from Hocus Pocus, just a few years out from that role. And Kelly Martin as Sherry, the girl he has a crush on. Lisa Jacob is in it as like the daughter of Beatniks. I know that she was in Mrs. Doubtfire, which I've actually never seen, but I always think of her. She's in George Lucas in Love as the character that inspires Leia.
I'm sorry, did you say George Lucas in Love?
Yes.
Is that the spiritual sequel to Shakespeare in Love? Is this we're just moving through through the ages?
Kind of. Technically, it's one of the Star Wars fan films from like the 90s when there was like that boom of them. It's
gotcha.
It's absolutely worth tracking down. You can find it on YouTube. It's like three minutes long. It's fantastic. It's got Robert Picardo and Dick Miller in it, and they're just delightful. And then I didn't recognize her at first, but I knew she looked familiar. Like, that's Naomi Watts in that weird, like My Brother the Shopping Cart movie.
Listen, I've been watching a lot of 60s Disney films recently, and it is 100% indicative of the kind of films they were putting out.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. It was a dead accurate kind of hilarious spoof of that kind of nonsense 60s Disney film.
Like, those movies came out later than this movie was set in, but I don't care.
Yeah.
So perfect.
But people who are nostalgic for this are nostalgic for that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Wendy. That's awesome. Dave, your first time, what'd you think?
Yeah, I really like this. It's like a nice little coming of age story. It's definitely a real love letter to the, not just like those kind of movies, but also kind of like the power of movies to get people through tough times. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that obviously there's this terrible, potentially devastating thing about to happen, and people are kind of going to see Mant because it's an escape. They don't have to think about it, you know, which felt upsettingly prescient. I'm disappointed that Mant isn't an entire film that we can watch, because there's enough of Mant in here to make me want the rest of it.
Yes. He shot 15 minutes worth of footage of it.
Yeah, I was like, come on, Joker. Like, if this was the early 2000s, they'd have made an entire Mant just to go with it as a publicity thing. Mm-hmm. Like they did with Machete. but yeah, it's all the kind of fake films are perfectly pitched kind of love letters and parodies of those sorts of films. As everyone has said, John Goodman is just fantastic. I mean, it's like John Goodman is one of those actors who's always amazing, but always kind of gets taken for granted, I think. Because he is always kind of quietly amazing in anything he's in, but he's very rarely the lead. He's like a fantastic character actor who always gives an amazing supporting performance. But you give him something like this, and yeah, he absolutely flies with it. Like, he's just kind of like, yeah, the way he kind of comes in, and the lead guy, is it the lead kid? Is it Jerry? No.
Gene.
I knew it started with a G. He kind of like almost kind of bewitches Gene by all of his kind of hucksterism. The fact that he's hired two guys to protest his own film just to stir up people so they can go see it. And like all the other kind of the bits that he's doing in the background, and Gene is just kind of entranced by him. And with Goodman's performance, you can see how a kid would be drawn in by somebody like that. Like he says to him towards the end, this is like you're more like a kid than an adult. And obviously you have some great kind of standard Joe Dante players in there, like Wendy said. You've got your Dick Millers and Robert Picardos and stuff, who are always value for money.
John Sayles.
Yeah. I had any criticism, I said like maybe there's a bit too much going on towards the end. With sort of the film going on and the kidnapping and then the balcony falling to bits, as well as your actual Cuban Missile Crisis happening. Maybe it's a bit kind of overloaded with incident towards the end, but it's a minor complaint. I think overall, it's definitely a very kind of charming love letter to film in general, film of that time, and how kind of like pop culture and entertainment can bring people together at a time of real crisis.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave. That's great. And I agree with pretty much everything everyone has said. John Goodman does not need us to tell him how amazing he is. Cause he's, as you say, he's one of those actors. Like, he can play the quiet guy. He can play the regular guy, and he can play the big loud guy. Just any Coen Brothers movie he's in, you get the big giant cartoon character. But here he's playing a guy who's basically just a regular guy who can turn on the big cartoon character when it's time to do that. And that's hard to do, surprisingly. And he does it really well. He can switch between those two modes really, really well. The scene where he's showing Gene around the movie theater and this is what we're doing. We're installing these in the seats, and that's where the rumbles go. And that's, where the smoke's going to go off and all that stuff. It's great. He's just he's so proud of all of his little gimmicks. he gets to show them off to this kid that's just lapping it all up. While at the same time, just going, the movie theater is a magical place. And again, this is one of those old fashioned movie theaters where, again, as soon as you walk in, you're smelling stale popcorn. The minute that those doors open, it's just hitting you in the face. It's got the balcony that, even on the best of days, feels like it's probably going to fall. it didn't probably need too much help to get there. But that's what those movie theaters are, and you forget your troubles and love that stuff.
Like I say, when he gives that inspiring speech to the film theater staff about, they're all contributing to the experience and how they're all going to go on this journey together as one team. And they're all they'll terrify people and they'll bring them to the edge of their seats, but then they'll make everything okay again and they will go home. And it's a real kind of talking up the magic of cinema and saying that everybody is important, from the person who takes the tickets to the person who sells the popcorn to the projectionist. Everybody's got a role to play in the overall experience of the film. And it's just kind of really inspiring.
It is. He's there to do he's doing his job. Mm. He's selling his product. He also does believe it. He believes in the magic of cinema. And that's really, really nice. I love that. Again, Mant is not the kind of movie that William Castle made, generally speaking. But it's very much a late 50s Cold War giant monster, tarantula, them,
yeah.
You know, type of, you know, science gone wrong. What hath science wrought kind of kind of movie. And they're goofy as fuck, but they're still a lot of fun. I love the Gene's little brother, who's like afraid of all these movies and still desperately wants to go see them. Yeah. That's great. You know, we all had little brothers like that, you know, or our friends did, or somebody in our circle that, you know, should not have under any circumstances been allowed to see these movies, but they're fun. So what's one sleepless night, you know, after being entertained by Mant. I love that. I love that name so much.
In a way, I feel like Mant was the way of kind of wrangling the Joe Dante-ness. Because overall, I think this is like, you know, for a Joe Dante film, this is quite low key. Mm-hmm. But I think sort of like just the fact that he went off and shot 15 minutes of Mant kind of got the Joe Dante-ness out of him, because it is bonkers. Yeah. Like at like one point towards the end of the film, like when there was a giant ant climbing the building, there's soldiers with gigantic bags of sugar trying to tempt it back down again. Like, it's like, what's his name? Bill. Bill, come down here!
And like, and again, like Wendy said, well, we've got all of these people in Joe Dante's orbit kind of just popping in and making, you know, like John Sayles wrote Piranha and wrote another Joe Dante movie. The Howling.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. We've got William Shallert and Kevin McCarthy are both in Mant. You know, the teacher is Charles Haas, who wrote this movie and wrote a bunch of other things too for Dante. Just, and of course, I mean, Picardo and Miller are in pretty much everything he makes.
Yeah.
It's so much fun. Oh, I got to watch The Burbs again, man.
Oh God, I've not seen The Burbs in ages.
Yeah. But anyway, I mean, just all of it is just so much fun. Just so much fun. Is it the best movie ever made? Nah. But it's such a good time. And the kids are really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The kids are really, really good in this movie. The only thing that I had going for is like, they're all kind of supposed to be in the same grade, but we've got like Lisa Jacob, who's clearly 14 years old, and Kelly Martin, who is clearly not. Yeah. right down to the, you know, she's clearly trying to seduce Hocus Pocus in this movie. With, yes, my last boyfriend taught me all kinds of things. Like, oh, you're 14. Stop.
Yeah,
it.
It's very creepy.
Yeah. And obviously, yeah, the ex-boyfriend is super creepy. Yeah, mm-hmm. He's got to be in like knocking on 20. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And once again, based off of an actual serial killer.
Yeah, you don't name your character Starkweather because you're trying to get the point across that he's a good guy.
Yeah. Simon Fenton, who played Gene, is British.
Yes, I do.
And the accent I can never leak through, I feel like kudos there.
In fact, Simon Fenton was in the second drama that Russell T. Davis ever wrote for the BBC called Century Falls. Which was if Dark Season was his sci-fi, then sort of like Century Falls was like his folk horror show for kids.
Okay.
And yeah, he was one of the leads in that.
Cool.
Yeah, and like Wendy was listing off some of the things that Omri Katz had done, but what I will always remember him for, he was Marshall on Erie, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Which I grew up with and, you know, still love to this day.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's an amazing show.
Yeah.
Like, sort of kind of like tween Twilight Zone, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a show that really should have gotten a better run than it did.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think the problem was it was kind of niche. Like, in a way, a lot of the references it was making was kind of going over the head of its target audience, and it was more for, like, the parents would have got a lot of the references rather than the kids who were watching it.
Yeah.
Yet the amazing thing is they reran it on Fox Kids like 5 or 6 years later, and it was a big enough hit where they were like, cool, let's do another season. Okay, but we can't actually use any of the original actors because they aged out of it, so we'll just do it. All the weirdness leaked into an alternate dimension, Erie, Indiana, with new characters.
I can't imagine that went over well.
It's an all right. It's not as good as the original.
Yeah, never is.
But then again, the original had a literal episode about all the dogs in town trying to kill a kid because he could hear them talk.
Oh, yeah.
They were not afraid to go dark. There's an episode where it turns out, all the rock videos are hiding satanic messages, and he plays it backwards, and it's literally just the dad berating his son. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think it was one of the first episodes where it's like there's a full-on Stepford family, and the reason they're not aging is because they're being kept in gigantic Tupperware.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird and fun show. The kids are
sleeping in Tupperware to the point where she's burping it when she's putting them to bed.
This was a Disney Channel show?
Foreverware. It was on NBC. Okay. And it was actually, I think Disney did actually air at one point.
Yeah, and Joe Dante directed a few episodes of it.
Of course.
Every now and then you get a showrunner or network or somebody that understands that kids actually do like to be genuinely scared of stuff. Mm. It's okay to throw dark shit at them sometimes. And this was a show that got that.
Yep. And Matinee also got that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love that. Again, and you kind of had to do this because it's a, you know, you're making one movie, you kind of have to make it really big. They basically threw almost every William Castle gimmick at this movie, including a few others. Like the guy in the monster suit running through the audience was actually from Ray Dennis Steckler, did that for Incredibly Strange Creatures, who stopped living and became mixed up zombies. You know, but you know, the gimmick thing was not. I just love that every single thing that they could throw at these kids, they threw at these kids. Mm. And at the end of it, you know, the movie theater's burned down, and everybody's outside, and the kids are just like, "I'm going to watch the shit out of this."
It's when the theater manager saying, "No, we can't. We're not going to have another screening today." And that little kid starts sweating hands at him.
My son's been looking forward to this all week.
You tell my kid you're not showing this movie. We're not showing this movie.
I mean, you had to have been somewhat prepared because you had a bomb shelter in the basement. Think of if you would have spent that money on actually, you know, keeping the theater up to code.
Oh, I did love that bit towards the end when, the kids are locked in and John Goodman sort of sitting there going, right, we just need to get hold of a couple of crowbars and some hammers if we could pop this right open. And the theater manager's going like, no, this is like, you know, like properly, like, you know, they gave me a warranty and everything. And he just goes, God, I'm in the wrong racket.
He says, we would never shortchange anybody. Would you like to learn?
Yeah, there is definitely a side order of P.T. Barnum in there, of that kind of like sort of the over the top showman who's not who would be able to, like, he wouldn't go out of his way to bilk you, but if you can get, if you happen to make a mistake, he's not going to tell you.
Yeah, and I love when they get the thing open and Simon and Sandra have clearly been making out. Yeah. The whole time, and they're like, "Are you okay?" And Chuck is just like, "He looks like he was doing okay." Oh, he's so great!
Yeah,
he's so great in this movie.
Yeah,
and part of that is because he's just such an entertaining character.
Yeah,
too. Just
yeah, I mean, like, it's the kind of character that if you give it to an actor like John Goodman, he's just going to take it and just run with it. You know, he's going to. Like, yeah, you cast John Goodman for a reason in a role like that because, yeah, he's got a similar sort of stature to that sort of like William Castle had, you know, that, yeah, they were both kind of those, kind of like physically quite big, larger than life men, but also with a lot of charisma to them as well.
Yeah, this is like up there with Big Lebowski in terms of just John Goodman being allowed to do whatever the fuck he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And just running with it.
Yeah. I will say the ending is very hopeful, but also the helicopters made me immediately remind myself, oh yeah, almost every male character in here is probably going to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is a weird weekend to have been watching this one.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's just going to leave it there. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming on and discussing these movies with us. This was a lot of fun. Thank you, listeners, for being here with us. And, oh, more than ever, please take care of yourselves. Drink some water. Go to bed.
Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show is presented by Wendy Abramo, Will Ackerman, Dave Probert, and DJ Tolland. Anyone out there making a monster movie, hit me up. I've already got my own big rubber ant costume. For reasons.
Yeah, it's just part two of directors that did...
Yeah.
With director's cuts, and we end up pairing it with, I don't know, Brazil.
That doesn't sound like the worst thing ever.
I mean, it sounds fantastic to me, but then again, I love Brazil.
Yeah.
It's peak,
no, I've never actually watched Brazil.
It's peak plastic sheeting and tubes falling from the ceiling. Like, that's his film aesthetic, and like, it's perfect in Brazil.
Yeah.
And it's technically a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
Well, we've got Christmas covered, then. Brilliant.
Well, you know, we've got Christmas in July next month.
Yeah. There's your after midnight right there.
Yeah, really.
We pair up Brazil, and we pair it up with, I don't know, the Princess Switch.
I'm not laughing because I fear it.
I may be all in on this plan.
Yeah.
Noted.
Well, we can definitely discuss this further. But right now.
Yes.